The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's program.
What I welcome is that we now have a US president, President Biden, who is strongly committed to NATO, to European security, and who is ready to invest more in NATO.
We'll have the very latest on the NATO summit in Brussels as the alliance prepares to outline their response to both Russia and China. Plus, we explore Israel's new government, tell you why Lisbon's mayor is facing calls to resign, and then...
Hi, I'm Jamie Waters, Monocle's regular contributor on fashion and retail. I'll be telling you why Ferrari is making moves on the catwalk while Netflix is launching a shopping site.
Thanks very much, Jamie. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. NATO is holding its summit in Brussels today as the alliance seeks to formulate its response to both China and Russia. The US President Joe Biden has been touring Europe in recent days, largely in a bid to shore up the international community's response to both Moscow and Beijing. Let's explore this further with Professor Daniela Schwalzer, Executive Director for Europe and Eurasia at the Open Society Foundations, and Monocle's editor Chris Jermak. Welcome to the program. Chris, if I may start with you, what do you think are the most burning issues to deal with at this NATO summit?
Well, Markus, let's start in a way with what is not going to be a burning issue, but will still be discussed. And that is the, as you heard at the top there, the U.S. commitment, if you will, to the NATO alliance. This was something that was, of course, a major issue in past summits under Donald Trump, where the U.S.'s commitment was somewhat under question. But now with Joe Biden there, you know, NATO is almost like Joe Biden's second home in some ways. It's something, you know, it's probably the most comfortable part of his trip to Europe this week. You know, even while Trump was in office, Joe Biden actually, you know, attended, for example, a Munich Security Conference to sort of show U.S. support for NATO. So this is really something that he feels very comfortable in offering that guarantee. So in that sense, you know, we now can move on to what the actual burning issues are for NATO compared to past summits. And that really, as ever, is, of course, Russia and Vladimir Putin, particularly ahead of Joe Biden's, summit with Vladimir Putin on Wednesday. That's going to be a very key issue, how to deal with Russia, also Belarus, and some of the issues that have come from that in recent weeks. And then also, you know, moving actually more and more out of that traditional Cold War era terrain, if you will, that NATO typically has, China is going to be a key discussion point in a way that it hasn't been before, how to deal with China militarily and economically. And then there's also general big questions about NATO's future direction. There's this 2030 agenda looking at what the new risks and areas are for NATO, things like incorporating climate change, cybersecurity into its agenda. And then also finally still about military spending at the end of the day. It will be interesting to see how hard Joe Biden kind of takes on European allies in terms of their spending. Many of them still are not spending, realizing their commitments on defense spending. So it'll be interesting to see whether he takes a line on that to kind of nudge them further in that direction or not.
Many issues to tackle over there. Daniela, the US officials have been already saying that this will be the first time indeed that NATO countries will be addressing the security challenge from China. What do you expect from those discussions? Will something be decided, and how much agreement is there between all those countries over how to deal with Beijing?
Well, I think the discussion only starts now, and it was good that some of the leaders had the chance to already get together during the G7 summit, where China also played a very big role, because the rhetoric on China still is quite different between Joe Biden and some European leaders. And the Europeans will seek not to rhetorically escalate the situation. While, of course, China is now perceived as a strategic competitor, as a challenger, but also as a partner, Europeans would not agree to calling China a threat, and I don't really think that Joe Biden would try and push it that far. But the point really is that NATO moves into new territory if it starts working on China. And the idea to put forward a new strategic concept to be adopted probably in 2022 is really a good moment to review, as Marcus just said, NATO's very traditional Cold War approach, which of course has been enlarged over the past years, for instance, by looking far more at new threats, hybrid threats, cyber, and so on. But geographically, we are at a point in time where not only the Americans, but also a number of European countries, in particular the UK and France, are putting more emphasis on their presence, for instance, in the Indo-Pacific.
Daniela, what about the question over Russian aggression? Is this the time for NATO countries now to rethink how to deal with Moscow?
The European position on Russia has really hardened over the past months. That was triggered by many events, the last one being the attack on the opposition politician Alexei Navalny, who was then treated in Germany. That really raised public attention, but also a lot of political attention, not only because of the violence against a single person, but also because Russia really openly breaches conventions, such as in this case the Chemical Arts Convention, and so there is really good reason to look at Russia. Also because Russia interferes heavily, not only within European countries, but has also interfered heavily with U.S. elections in the past. So. There is a need for Europeans, and the Americans from a European perspective should be part of that, to review with Russia what kind of security order we can have going forward. Because as not only EU countries, but in particular also the Eastern Neighborhood countries feel, the current situation where there's constant disturbance and uncertainty, insecurity, and NATO has stepped up its presence on the eastern flank years ago, this is a situation that they all want to get out of. So I think it is a moment with this new American leadership to really also rediscuss Russia.
Chris, you mentioned already that there are some other new themes being discussed this time around that have been barely getting any attention before: cybersecurity, AI in defense, and also climate change.
Yes, exactly. So this is part of this discussion of sort of new areas that I find are quite interesting that NATO is slowly getting involved in. One, yes, is cybersecurity, which is perhaps the one that's been most discussed, you could say. But there is this talk of essentially a cybersecurity defense strategy for NATO. And of course, we have seen a fair amount in the news recently of cyber attacks, hacker attacks, holding companies, holding countries ransom in various parts of the world. And that's really what this is about. It's almost turning cybersecurity into a defense issue, and about shoring up NATO and its allies' defenses against cyber attacks. And then also it goes in a way back to a Cold War era thing, if you will, because it's targeting Russia in some ways. Many of these hacker gangs tend to operate out of Russia. And so one of the things that NATO is looking for is you know, kind of to come down harder on Russia to deal with these threats, you know, and to deal with hackers in its own territory, if you will. And then, yes, there's other issues that are interesting. One is just quickly artificial intelligence, just what the line is in terms of military weapons, when artificial intelligence can be used and not. That's going to be a key issue for the Allies to agree on. And finally, climate change security is a new kind of issue that's quite interesting. It's not something you'd necessarily think fits into defense, but in some ways it does. One way is the melting ice caps in the Arctic Circle will open up new competition in the Arctic. That's quite an issue that even Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, has said could usher in a new Cold War of competition between Russia, China, and the US. But also just how climate change affects military operations, wear and tear, sandstorms, and how they affect flights, all those kinds of things in terms of just military equipment is also quite interesting and will be discussed at the summit.
Daniel, just finally, it's probably safe to assume that the mood at the summit is going to be different now with Joe Biden in power in the US. What will it take for him to undo the damage done by Donald Trump?
Well, this is first of all a huge trust building exercise, and he started with the G7 summit to do just that. The many bilateral meetings, the sequence of group discussions of agreements which were taken both at the G7, and then there will obviously be a communique after tonight's meeting. All these are very positive political signals. I think one of the big issues, again, from a European perspective, is how do Europeans get the balance right? And first of all, seeing, yes, there is a U.S. president, we can trust him. He stands by the alliance. He invests into transatlantic relations immensely. He also has expectations vis-a-vis the Europeans. But then this knowledge that in 4 years, this can again be over, and there could be another sort of Trump-like presidency where the alliance is questioned. And so the careful balance that Europeans need to strike is to invest more in their own defense and do it in a way that the Americans actually see it is good for the alliance. It is good for transatlantic cooperation. In the end, it's good for the United States. But without using any rhetoric that would suggest to those who are critical of what Joe Biden does in transatlantic relations in, for instance, the U.S. Congress, who could then say, okay, they are turning away from us. So this discussion was very much alive during the Trump years, that whenever Europeans made a step forward in their own defense efforts, in their own cooperation on procurement, and in their own development of the armament industry here on our continent, this was seen skeptically from DC. And so the moment is now to find a balance between a stronger contribution to the transatlantic alliance in Europe's own self-interest, because we have to prepare for a future where we will have to take, or we probably will have to take more care of ourselves, and to deliver a strong commitment to NATO.
Daniela Schwarzer and Chris Chermak, thank you very much for joining us. Now here is Monocle's Daniel Bache with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Israel's new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has vowed to unite the nation following 2 years of political stalemate. The right-wing nationalist succeeds Benjamin Netanyahu, who was forced out of office after 12 years. We'll have much more on this story after today's headlines. Police in Nicaragua have detained five more prominent opposition figures as the country's widespread political crackdown continues. Several former allies of longtime President Daniel Ortega were among those arrested. The charge sheet includes inciting foreign interference in Nicaragua's affairs. Swiss voters have narrowly rejected the federal government's plans for a car fuel levy and a tax on air tickets. Switzerland's leaders want to dramatically reduce emissions by 2030, and the measures were designed to help the Alpine nation meet targets under the Paris Agreement on climate change. And today's Monocle Minute reports on the renovation of Yemen's Sana'a International Airport, which could be about to reopen to the rest of the world. The move would be a hugely positive step for the war-torn nation, and you could read more of our analysis by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Now back to you, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Daniel. We're going to head to Israel now to get the latest on the country's new government. The unprecedented coalition of parties was approved yesterday with the smallest of majorities. I'm joined on the line from Jerusalem by Alison Kaplan-Summer, a journalist for Harrods. Welcome to the program. So Alison, This is big news for Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu has been unseated as the country's longest-serving leader. Tell me what it took to find an agreement on the new coalition government.
Well, it wasn't an easy task. It took many weeks of hardcore negotiations to form this coalition in which pretty much the glue that held them together is their opposition to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and feeling that it was an urgent mission to get him out of office. Now, that's kind of pretty thin glue to hold very disparate parties together, ranging from hard right parties very committed to holding territory in the West Bank and a vision of the greater land of Israel, to parties on the extreme left of the Israeli political spectrum who are strongly committed to a Palestinian state and a two-state solution. And just to add some interest to the mix, we've also got Islamist party, the first Arab party to play such a key prominent role in an Israeli government coalition.
So what do you expect from this coalition government now and from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett?
Well, what they say they're there to do is to, A, unite the nation, which is going to be very difficult in view of the fact that outgoing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the new head of the opposition declared in his speech in the Knesset yesterday that he will fight daily against this terrible, dangerous left-wing government in order to topple it. So that's not really an easy path to unity. And they say that they want to focus on helping the country recover from the coronavirus pandemic, pull the economy together, improve infrastructure, improve education, basically avoid these sort of existential issues involving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That's their goal. But as we know, events are likely to overtake them, and they are going to have to find some way to navigate those issues as well.
What is also interesting is that this power-sharing deal also means that Bennett will only remain as prime minister up until 2023, as Israel will get another leader then.
Yes, he's going to rotate out in a year and a half, and Yair Lapid from the centrist party, Yesh Atid, will take over. So again, Naftali Bennett himself is strongly on the record as having a commitment to the right wing of Israeli politics as far as the conflict is concerned, and he has outlined plans that would involve annexing parts of the West Bank. But in this government coalition and looking ahead to a different prime minister taking over in a year and a half, it's very doubtful that he could make any moves towards making his vision of what he thinks Israel should be a reality.
Thank you very much for this, Alison. That was Alison Kaplan Summer in Jerusalem, and you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Lisbon's Mayor Fernando Medina is facing calls to resign over reports that City Hall accidentally shared details of three Russian organizers of a rally in support of the jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Let's get the latest now with Monocle 24's Carlota Rebello. Regular listeners will know that Carlos is originally from Portugal. Welcome to the program. So, Carlota, how much is known of what actually happened? How does the City Hall accidentally share details of protest organizers with the Russian embassy and foreign ministry?
So it's still quite muddled how the information ended up being forwarded from City Hall to the Russian embassy. Fernando Mendida and his team are saying it was a bureaucratic error, but basically, with COVID-19 regulations, protest organizers had to provide personal info more than usual, just because of contact tracing and ensuring that even with COVID, people were able to, you know, exercise their right of freedom of speech and of protesting. And this was a march in support of Alexei Navalny. So they had to provide not only their name, but their home addresses, their mobile phone, a lot of personal data. So that's the first step of this story, which is how City Hall even had this data to begin with. And then through this, and the idea is if something happened, if there was a positive case or if there was an issue, the police, they had the direct contacts of the organizers. And somehow through this email chain, one of the organizers was able to spot that some of the data had been forwarded to the Russian embassy.
What kind of a bureaucratic mistake is that?
Exactly. And that's what everyone is asking. Carlos Moedas, who's a former Portuguese member of the European Parliament, has asked for this to be debated in the European Parliament because it is a very worrying and dangerous mistake to happen. And, you know, the fact that municipal employees have forwarded the data to, you know, not only the Russian embassy in Lisbon, but also to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Moscow. It's quite insane. You know, one of the organizers, Asha Fulina, who's Russian Portuguese, she has Portuguese citizenship as well. She's a dissident and she's been in Portugal for 8 years. She also has Portuguese citizenship. So why does Moscow need to know that she is organizing a protest again to support Alexei Navalny? It is all very concerning.
It does indeed raise many, many questions. What have we heard from the mayor and from the City Hall so far?
City Hall is adamant this was just a bureaucratic mistake, that they, of course, you know, as expected, are all going to do due diligence and an internal survey and inquiry into figuring out exactly how this happened. But, you know, at the end of the day, even if it is true, it was just an accidental mistake, it could have put these people in danger for their life or beyond that. It's also a breach of privacy laws. Why does another country need to know this sort of information? There are calls for Medina to resign over this. Even if the mistake didn't come directly from him, it is his City Hall. Ultimately, it needs to stop with him. And, you know, in the meantime, six different members of the European Parliament from Portugal have asked the European Council President Charles Michel and also Josep Borrell, who's the foreign policy chief of the Council, to look into this and to, you know, ask if the actions from Lisbon City Hall are even in line with European values and the diplomatic practices that the EU has towards Russia. So this is escalating to a bigger issue, which is it's not only about these three individuals and the danger for their lives, but is this mistake also in breach of European, not law, but the European values, what holds the European Union together?
Exactly. When I do my COVID checks when I enter different places and give my details, I'm not expecting that information to be shared with any embassies, for example. Do you think there could be something more sinister going in the background? How much do we know of relations, say, between the mayor and Russia, or officials and Russia?
So, you know, it's quite strange because Portugal was among, Lisbon, the Portuguese capital, was among the 90-plus capitals around the world that allowed an organized protests to ask for Alexei Navalny to be freed. So that this action goes completely against then the practice of releasing this information. So it is really strange. And, you know, the fact that in the middle of a pandemic, there's no issues in allowing this sort of march to happen, that the City Hall has stressed many times the importance of having freedom of speech, the importance of allowing people to feel that they're part of a community, particularly foreigners in the country. And then, you know, this happens. I mean, we need to say the City Hall, Lisbon City Hall, has said several times they completely reject any accusations or even any insinuation that they're complicit to the Russian regime. But, you know, it is a really severe mistake. And as you say, it's very difficult not to think, how does this even happen if there's not some sort of intention behind it? But we will know more in the next coming days. And now there's a bigger inquiry to see if the same sort of data about other foreigners has been shared. So far, it doesn't seem like that, but it is quite worrying.
Well, we look forward to hearing more from you, Carlotta, when we hear more from Lisbon. That was Monocle's own Carlotta Rebello, and you are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally on today's programme, we're going to round up the latest news from the world of fashion and retail. I'm joined in the studio by the regular Monocle 24 contributor, Jamie Waters. Good afternoon to you, Jamie. Let's start by talking about Ferrari, luxury car manufacturer, hosted its first ever fashion show yesterday. Why is this brand moving into fashion?
Yeah, it was an interesting move. They hosted a runway show, their first ever runway show in their factory in Italy. And it's, you know, they're launching it. You know, they've launched a proper fashion line. They're launching a series of dedicated fashion stores. And, you know, this is a proper move into the fashion industry from, you know, the luxury car maker, which is interesting. I mean, basically, they're diversifying the brand and kind of, I guess they really want to emphasize the fact that they're a luxury brand and a lifestyle brand, quote unquote, not only a car manufacturer, which is something that we have seen from the industry. Like, you know, Mercedes and brands like that are often partnering with fashion brands. And I think we're also seeing it, we've seen it from the other side as well, where we've seen fashion brands like Louis Vuitton is now, it's a luxury brand, it's a lifestyle brand. So I basically think this is an interesting move. It's kind of coming from the karmic, from the other side, but it's like this idea of high-end luxury brands, an all-encompassing lifestyle brand. They embody a full lifestyle, whether that's cars, whether it's clothes, whether it's hotels and travel, this full world that they're creating. And I think this is a really part of a move by Ferrari to do that.
Do you think that's a wise move? How much excitement is there in fashion circles about this now?
It's received a lot of traction in fashion circles. I think there's a few things. I think it's clever because I think if you do it well, what you can do is with fashion is you get on young people's radars a lot of the time. You know, this has been launched. I think the collection has been launched on High Snobiety, which has a really young kind of streetwear follower base. You know, you can get clothes on celebrities, you can stay on people's radars and stay relevant and be part of the news cycle in a way that fashion allows that the car industry doesn't, it's not reaching that same audience. I think for something like car brands, because obviously a lot of people can afford the clothes. The clothes are their high-end clothes, but obviously a lot of people can afford them who can't afford a car. So you're getting on people's radars and getting them to buy into the brand, and then maybe in 10 years, once they've built up that affinity, they can afford a car.
Well, let's continue then with another news story you have for today. Netflix has launched a shopping site. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So they've launched a shopping site. So now what they're doing is you can shop exclusive collections connected to, you know, their hit shows. So I think they're launched with a collection from Lupin. It makes a lot of sense. You know, it's kind of yet another step in shopifying our entertainment, our every experience, everything we do now seems to be, you know, you can click a tab and it's like buy this thing and buy into this world.
Do you think it's going to be any different from all the other online shopping opportunities and services you find at the moment? I'm thinking about Amazon and the likes of that.
The thing that I thought of straight away when I read about this was Instagram, which has launched, I think it was last year or even the year before, launched the shopping app where people would click post. They swapped that specific tab, so it's now shop. So they made it very front and center. In some ways, this isn't new at all in terms of an entertainment company launching. If you think Disney, a lot of that empire is built on merchandise. What makes sense for Netflix is that, and I heard, you know, that they were quoted as saying that the cycle of Netflix hit shows is much quicker than something like a Disney. So something from Netflix gets viral and then people are sort of over it in a couple of weeks. So all of which is to say it makes sense for them to have this online platform where it's very immediate, it's very quick. And I think they will capitalize on the hype. I think a lot of people will buy these things. You know, they see a show and they want to buy into that hype immediately.
Let's continue to Israel next. That country has become the first in the world to ban fur. What does that mean in practice?
I think this story is interesting because in the last couple of years, there's been this growing movement towards banning fur and kind of exotic skins and things like that. And this is the first time that a country has done it. California famously did it in 2019. It's been debated in New York as banning it, but this is the first time a country has done it. You know, critics have said that it may not have that much of an impact in practice because they've made an exception for furs used for religious purposes. And the shtreimel, which is the fur hat worn by Hasidic Jewish men, on various religious occasions, those are made from fir, and that is the main use of fir in the country. So they're saying in practice it may not have that much of an impact. And I think this is this thing that will come up, this issue that will come up with banning certain animal products and uses of clothing is when they come up against religious and cultural associations. And when New York was debating banning fur, a lot of rabbis and also pastors from African American community, they were against it for those kind of reasons. So I think it's going to raise these issues. It's not going to be as simple as this kind of ban, younger generation saying, let's ban these things for ethical reasons. There's going to be this clapback from, you know, from religious and kind of, you know, these cultural kind of institutions.
And just finally, and in brief, if you may, Dior is hosting a cruise show in Athens later this week. Jamie, is this a sign that the fashion cycle is slowly getting back to its pre-pandemic ways?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is obviously throughout the pandemic, people have said maybe this will be lead to brands rethinking how they do things. And I think in some ways that has happened. But this weekend, we've just had the London Men's Shows held online, which is a kind of the new way of doing things. But in the same week, Dior hosting this big cruise show in Athens. It is a return to how things were done. It will be one of the biggest in-person shows since the pandemic started. You know, apart from anything else, there's huge demand among these high-end customers for travel clothes, luxury clothes, that kind of lifestyle. So I'm sure there's big demand, and I think it is a bit of a return to normality.
Thanks, Jamie. That was the fashion and retail expert Jamie Waters. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our studio manager was Maylie Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.